You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 17th, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Rebecca Watson.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
My kung fu is strong.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everybody.
What's up, Evan?
Bob is still unavailable. October's a bad month for Bob.
In general.
I think it's actually the best month for Bob, just not for the podcast.
Yeah, right.
But honestly, Steve, Bob says he's working.
That's his story.
His company's doing a $22 million software deploy, and Bob's the guy that does the final step. So
he presses enter. Is that what happens?
He has to be there.
Can he get a drinky bird to do that for him?
I love
So you know what I noticed? I noticed that this is our 117th episode.
Okay.
It's October 17th, 2007. It's a lot of sevens.
That kind of means nothing, actually. Yeah. That would be 10-17, not 1-17.
To you, it means nothing. To a numerologist, it means everything.
Yeah. Well, I guess a zero means nothing, so you can get rid of it anyway. So that would be 117.
Yes, my psychic numerologist told me this would be a very auspicious day.
And I like 7-up, too, so this is getting strange.
That is weird.
Another big announcement, Rebecca's birthday.
Yes, happy birthday,
yeah.
Rebecca.
I almost forgot.
Yeah, just like you said last year.
How old are you now?
Well, I'm 26 for the next 3 hours, and on October 18th. I will turn 27.
20 what?
27.
20 what?
7. 27.
Oh, my God.
See,
Steve,
the 7 came up again.
The hair on my neck just stood up. This is getting... what's happening?
It's crazy. Maybe I'm the Antichrist. Is that what that means?
I hope so. At least I won't get killed in the onslaught, right?
Yeah, Jay, wow. Just close your eyes. You'll be fine.
Yeah, that's the ticket.
So let's go on to some news. We have an interview coming up later in the show with Mark Crislip of Quackcast. We're going to talk about flu vaccines and myths surrounding them. But first, a few news items. An artificial intelligence researcher, David Levy, of the University of Maastricht in the Netherlands, told Live Science that he believes that sex and marriage with robots is right around the corner. Or
That's
at least
no
by
big news.
By 2050.
Jay's been having sex with inanimate objects for the last 20 years.
Yeah, but
that's true. But this is—he's talking about robots now, not just inanimate objects.
Yeah, he's saying that they kind of push back, and you know, nothing I own pushes back yet.
So. Literally,
we're talking Cylon warriors and that gay robot from Lost in Space.
Oh my God, Evan! What, you're going to be having sex with a robot? It's going to be like
not me.
Your command. That's not sexy, dude.
I didn't say it was sexy. This whole thing is creeping me out, frankly.
Evan, I think he's thinking more of either Westworld or Cherry 2000. Those are
Evan.
Those
are you
robots are pretty hot?
You don't want to buy a robot?
No thanks.
Okay.
No thanks. Love my wife. Thank you. Perfectly fine.
Would it be cheating if you had sex with a robot and you were married?
I have to consult my robot moral program, I guess, to figure that out.
It wouldn't
out.
Be cheating if you had sex with a fleshlight, though, right? Where's the line?
If you start having feelings for it, that's when it's cheating.
I do sense that there's a fuzzy line there of when does having sex with a robot become actual infidelity? Does it have to be artificially intelligent?
Yeah, and at what point does it officially become a robot?
Well, not really, at least not with respect to how intelligent it is. I mean, you can have robots on the assembly line in Detroit making cars. Those are still called robots.
Steve, a lot of men don't care about the intelligence thing. I mean, that's, you can find that anywhere. The a couple of the issues I have is, one, 2050, that's him just picking a round number out of, I don't think he actually sat there and thought, well, where are we at now? How long will it take to get to where it would need to be for there to be?
Yeah, I'm thinking like May 2050, April maybe, tops. Yeah.
He probably said 2050 because he won't be around in case he's wrong to be, scrutinized.
And also, of course people are going to be having sex with robots. Of course. It's like, no duh. Why even write an article about this?
I think marriage would be a big step, and that won't happen by 2050. I mean, come on.
Levy is predicting that Massachusetts, which is a very liberal or progressive state, will be the first one to legalize marriages between humans and robots.
Right,
but, you know,
we've got gay marriage and MIT, which together equals robot marriage, obviously.
Robots would have to be considered citizens, right?
You would think that that would be a prerequisite.
Well, you can talk about marriage in terms of what the church would sanctify, for instance, or there's also marriage as a legal term. I mean, is that what he's referring to? Does a robot require legal rights?
I don't think most churches are going to go for it. I mean, it's just so obviously not.
The Unitarians will.
Oh, they go for anything. Maybe we'll need a separate designation, like a Silicon Union, in order to rather than a marriage.
Or they'll probably be robot church by then, right?
Yeah, robot church.
There are two elements to this. One element is just the physical technology, the technology to simulate a person in a way that it would be suitable for the task of lovemaking. But the second is artificial intelligence. Would the robot, or what degree of intelligence or artificial intelligence would it have? Of course, this is going to be a moving target. This is going to be changing, you know, as technology progresses. But these are two separate variables. You could have a physical robot, either male or female, that could perform all of the physical tasks and have no self-awareness at all. To literally, you know, it could be have the intelligence of a PC, but just have whatever algorithms are in there to make it behave, its behavior be appropriate. Or it could be something that is fully artificially intelligent at the other end of the spectrum, even to the point that it would have its own feelings. And that's when we get into all kinds of touchy area, like, you know, does it have rights, and should it have rights as a citizen, as a person, as an individual?
I think that this is the point in time when a Mac would take over the market from the PC because it would be more aesthetically pleasing and not get as many viruses.
Okay.
That I could imagine why how that would be an advantage in this arena. Yes.
Well, what would you call it? Like iLay or
the iLay? But there would always be a compatibility problem, though. That's the problem with the Mac.
But and then there's the underground world of robot prostitution and other related activities.
Oh, that's
robot
true.
Prostitution.
Yeah.
Would there be robot pimps then?
Oh, sure.
You bitch, where's my money?
With spaces between their teeth and gold chains and the works.
Robot,
you know,
pimp. That's probably the sexiest thing I've heard all day. Robot pimp.
Well, I mean, it certainly seems like this speculation is a little bit ahead of the curve. It is fun to think about it, but I think we have a few more years to digest what the implications of these things. Well, the next news item. Scientists have discovered genes for overeating.
What are these, like genes that have an elastic waist?
They've identified genes associated with a tendency to be obese. Although this was a small study, they looked at 29 obese and 45 non-obese adults and comparing their DNA samples. What they found is that the obese subjects had less of a response to a neurotransmitter called dopamine. Dopamine is involved with reward systems in the brain. So the hypothesis is that they get less of a reward from the kind of activity that normally is reinforced by dopamine, and therefore, such as eating. So therefore, they have to eat more in order to get the same reward sensation compared to other people. So that leads to them overeating, eating more. And they've identified genes that correlate with that. So this is interesting. You know, I think that the area of looking at how genes correlate to different behaviors and neurological functions is a burgeoning field. And this is another example of that, you know, sort of breaking down our behavior into pieces, into subsets of our behavior, and then trying to see, well, what structures result in that behavior, influence it, and one step even more reductionist, what genes lead to, you know, to those, or influence the function of those structures. So this won't necessarily lead to a cure for obesity anytime soon, but certainly the more we understand about it, the goal always, of course, is in translational research to use this basic science knowledge of how things work to lead to better treatments. But
that's interesting. So, Steve, would they be able to, say, take a mildly overweight person someday, alter their genes, and, you know, I guess what this would do would be give them more of a reward, and they would tend to eat less, and then it could be used to make people perfectly skinny?
There are certainly people who are genetically more predisposed to obesity than others, although, there, of course, there are huge environmental influences as well. The rates of obesity in this country have been steadily increasing over the last 30 years, and that kind of increase and that rate of increase can't really be explained on the basis of genetics. There has to be an environmental influence. Gene therapy, that's a ways off, in my opinion. So I don't think that's something that we're going to be doing anytime soon. But I think the more likely application of this would be to design a drug, maybe targeting those people with this specific genetic makeup that would compensate for their tendency to overeat. You know, we're just at the beginning of the age of pharmaceuticals that are tailored towards specific genetics. You know, now it's basically we studied in a bunch of people. We look for a trend of efficacy and safety, and then in an individual patient, it's trial and error. And we know that not all patients respond to drugs the same way. So the goal for the next 20 or 30 years is to begin to predict how individuals are going to respond to a specific drug by looking at their genetic makeup. This is definitely something that we're going to be seeing, you know, in the next decade or two. And we were already at the very beginning of it starting to see it. So this kind of information could lead to that, targeting specific pharmacotherapy to individuals with the specific genetic makeup.
That's awesome. And I've read about this. It's not just for a specific thing like this. Like, they were saying that they would be able to manufacture all kinds of drugs, even drill down to the individual, not just a type.
Yeah, that's right. There's still a lot to be worked out. This is one small study. You know, you need to look at more patients. You need to, you know, ask questions different ways. You know, once you answer one question, that usually spawns a dozen other ones. And, you know, it's going to take a while for this line of research to mature to the point where we could be making specific, you know, clinical interventions based upon it. But it is a good start, and I do think that there's a lot of promise in this basic approach. The next news item, this is just a cool news item I wanted to talk about very quickly. A new dinosaur fossil was found. Paleontologists have unearthed a 105-foot plant eater, which is called Futolancosaurus duckii. Futolancosaurus duckii. I may have butchered that name a little bit. Named after the Mapuche Indian words for giant and chief. This was discovered in Argentina. It is a sauropod dinosaur, so this is the largest of the dinosaurs, you know, the ones with the long necks, the plant eaters, and long tails. What's unique about this fossil specimen is that it was 70% preserved. That is astounding. That is an incredible specimen. Most other fossil finds are we find about 10% of the bones of an individual. Now, of course, because there's bilateral symmetry, theoretically you could find 50% of a fossil and know what the entire organism looked like if you found like the entire left side but not the right side. It never works out that perfectly. So maybe, you know, with 10% of the fossils, maybe it's somewhere between 15 to 18 or so percent you can infer based upon the bilateral symmetry. 70% is just amazing. I mean, they probably are able to reconstruct almost the entire thing. So that's an excellent specimen.
So I wonder if they've reconstructed it yet, if they've made any renderings. I'd love to see it.
I've seen, you know, there are some renderings. We'll link to the reports. They're a little bit preliminary. It takes time to make casts of the fossils and put them all together. This dinosaur lived about 88 million years ago. So this is towards the end of the Cretaceous era, right at the end of the age of dinosaurs. The other thing that's interesting about this is that, you know, the fossils that we find are dependent upon us finding these windows, these fossil windows, which basically means we find some strata, some fossil bed somewhere where it gives us a snapshot of some place and time. And then, you know, we may find a lot of rich fossils from that area. So we get a detailed look at the animals that were living at a certain period of time. It's sort of that we're looking wherever the light is good. Wherever we find a good fossil bed, we get it. That's a good light into that period of time. And there would be other places and times where we don't have any good fossil beds, and we have these huge gaps in our fossil reconstruction of the past, simply because we haven't found a well-preserved bed from that period of time. So there is a series of fossils coming out of Argentina in that area where we have some excellent fossil finds, fossil specimens. So I predict we'll be seeing even more of these types of finds coming out of that area in Brazil and Argentina.
And some big ones, too.
Actually, I was trying to find all of the taxonomy of this dinosaur, and it's more complicated than I had remembered. So this is part of the Titanosauria, which includes the other, which is underneath the sauropods, which includes other dinosaurs like Brachiosaurus, for example. The taxonomy of dinosaurs is really complicated. So, for example, this is a member of the class Sauropsida, the superorder Dinosauria, the order Sauricia, the suborder Sauropodomorpha, the infraorder Sauropoda, or there's an unranked level, the Titanosauria, and then the superfamily Titanosauridae. So they keep having to add these new levels to the ranking system whenever, you know, when the family tree gets more and more complicated. It's really almost a broken system. You know, you have to go superorder, order, suborder, infraorder. Gets kind of crazy. And then they have one they haven't even figured out how to name yet.
They, they said that this new find is the third largest dinosaur that I guess they've ever found. And the other two larger dinosaurs than this one were also found in South America.
Yep.
So I don't know. I just find that a little bit interesting that you would think, you know, just so much more land in the northern hemisphere. It winds up that in the southern hemisphere, you actually had the largest of the dinosaurs. And
that family of big dinosaurs were in that place and time where we're finding fossils. Mm. It's like the China feathered dinosaur spines. Why are all the feathered dinosaurs coming out of China? Because we have a fossil window there at a time and place when there were a lot of feathered dinosaurs. It doesn't necessarily mean that's the only time and place that they were in history, so that's the only one where we have a window.
Predictions are going to be that we're going to find more of these dinosaurs.
Yes.
In that same location, Evan?
You have a productive bed like this, you can expect a series of findings, not just a single one. That's right. The last news item is part of our ongoing series on why you shouldn't join cults.
In case you had any questions.
Right. This is a Japanese cult that is dominated by women. It's a female-dominated cult in Japan.
So far, so good.
Yep. And this is the Kijinkai cult.
Their kung fu is lousy.
This is... They beat to death a 63-year-old woman as part of one of their cult rituals. So the authorities, you know, they're checking up on the situation. They sent in 200 police officers to raid their location and make some arrests.
It wasn't a part of a ritual, Steve. They killed her because she supposedly messed up a ritual.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it was a long-term beatings that were... It wasn't like they just decided just to instantly kill her. The beatings were part of some kind of ongoing ritual. Why they decided to do that, you're right. I mean,
So allegedly for failing to carry out a group ritual properly.
Yeah, she basically was beaten up. It was like an hour-long ordeal where she was punched and kicked. And they also think that, obviously that this behavior wasn't unique to the situation, that it had been going on for a while.
I don't know, there's something scary about a female-dominated cult.
It's Amazonian.
I mean, what makes that scarier than a male-dominated cult?
Yeah, where are you going with that, Steve?
Because I'm a guy?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Fair enough.
I think there's a sexy element to me. Because I get these crazy ideas.
Because you're into that kind of thing?
Because you're probably thinking of Monty Python and the Holy Grail and, a spanking.
I'm ignorant of Japanese culture and history, but I've always assumed that the women have been very repressed in Japanese culture for many, 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 many years until post-World War II.
So you think there's a lot of pent-up rage that they're getting out?
Maybe. I don't know if the article talks about when this sect came into being.
35 years.
So, yeah, there you go. So it's
one of the crazy things, I've never heard this before, said so blatantly, but one of the cult's rules is that before a person or when a person becomes a member, their whole family has to join.
Well, that's not altogether divorced from what we normally see with cults, where they try to separate you from your family if they're not also in the cult. Generally, if you want in, you need to reject your family, so the cult becomes your family. So I don't find that surprising in the least.
I just was thinking of the idea that, somebody meets a member of the cult, they get romance, they want to join the cult, and then at some point they have to be told, okay, your entire family have to join before we're going to really let you in. Like a multi-level marketing style. And apparently people are successful. They go back, they talk to their families, they get the whole family to join. And that's what happened to this woman.
What I find interesting is that the article, it says it's not an all-female cult, obviously.
It's just
they're bringing their whole families into it.
Yeah.
It's female-dominated, is
right.
What they say. So I find it interesting that that's mentioned in the very first sentence. It's a secretive, female-dominated cult.
Yeah, well, that's an unusual feature. Most cult leaders are men.
Right. That's what I guess I find interesting, and I wonder why that is.
I think Evan is definitely onto something with the traditional sort of female repression in Japan.
But it's not just Japan. I mean, name a female-dominated cult here in the U.S.
No, my point is, because they're so repressed, that could lead to a cult where the women are actually more brutal because they have a lot of this repressed anger over their position. Now, interestingly, that's speculation. I don't know if that's actually the case. The article says that the cult began as a group of fortune tellers and that they use various techniques to extract a lot of money from their followers. Like they sell pebbles, which are called spiritual stones, for the article here is British, so they say 1,200 pounds each. They also sell an elixir called Kagensu, which they claim cures cancer.
Ooh.
Although apparently it's just bottles of regular water.
It's homeopathic.
Right.
So just chalk one more death up to a cult activity.
Yep. Who knows what tomorrow will bring.
Well, let's go on to your questions and emails. The next email comes from Jennifer Lamb in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And Jennifer writes, "My boyfriend is unfortunately somewhat racist and is trying to prove to me that white people are better. Here's the story he sent me." Then she links to an article. "And is this scientist credible? Do you really think that they can find differences in genes?" Well, the article she links to and the scientist to whom she is referring is none other than James Watson of Watson and Crick fame. So he is a geneticist who's now 79 years old.
Noted kook.
Who is the co-discoverer of the structure, the helical structure of DNA, has almost a legendary status, as a famous scientist. And he is on a lecture tour, and he is raising up quite a fuss by some of the comments that he is making. For example, he commented about Africa, saying that all our social policies are based on the fact that their intelligence is the same as ours, whereas all the testing says not really. People who have to deal with black employees find this not true.
Well, that sounds like hard science to me.
Yeah. It says there's no firm reason to anticipate that the intellectual capacities of people's geographically separated in the revolution should prove to have evolved identically. Our wanting to reserve equal powers of reason as some universal heritage of humanity will not be enough to make it so.
So, Steve, to put it in layman's terms, is he saying when you average out the testing scores that black people have lower IQ or they don't test as well?
It's essentially an IQ argument, and there's multiple layers of problems in this field. As we discussed in an earlier episode, the concept of race in and of itself is an extremely fuzzy thing. What we're mostly looking at is your continent of origin, the continents did separate the human race for thousands of years, and obviously, there were some genetic differences occurred. We can measure those genetic differences. But there's also a tremendous amount of mixing of the races, so the separations are not clean. There's been debate about how much, percentage-wise or by some quantitative measure, how much of a difference is there between the races. And there's lots of reasons to say that race is not that important in terms of the overall genetic picture of humanity. There is more variation within an identifiable group, like Caucasians or Africans or Asians, than there is between the groups in terms of overall genetics. So the concept of race is a very fuzzy and very difficult one. At the same time, the concept of IQ is a very difficult concept because it's measuring something that is just a representation of intelligence, but it's very dependent upon what you choose to measure and how you define intelligence. Intelligence is not one thing. It's a very multifarious thing. That doesn't mean to say that there aren't identifiable genetic populations and that there aren't things that you can measure that are meaningful about cognition or brain function. It's just there's a lot of fuzziness and there's a lot of problems with definition. So that's where the debate comes in. If you give some standardized test to groups of people who are identified in some way as belonging to one group or another, there are statistical differences between those groups in some studies. So if you want to believe that there's a difference in IQ between different races, you could look at that data like Watson does and say, see, there's a difference. But you can also look at the same data and say, well, we're just measuring cultural bias here. This is a measure of just, the IQ test itself is culturally biased, and that's really the only thing that we're measuring. We're just choosing to look at certain subsets of intelligence that are giving these different answers. Or you could say, the tests that are better measured show smaller differences, that the more fuzzy the measurement, the bigger the difference. So that's a pattern that's consistent with just cultural bias. So, there's enough uncertainty that you can look at the data and come to different conclusions about it. What that says to me is that there isn't a huge undeniable difference between clearly identified groups. Because if there were, there wouldn't be really much of a debate about it. So there is a lot of uncertainty. But what Watson said in that second paragraph, when he said it's unreasonable to assume that we're not going to find any differences, I'm paraphrasing, but what he's really saying is that, when we look at different populations, we're going to see different gene frequencies in those populations. And there's no reason to assume a priori that any gene that correlates with cognitive ability or intelligence, regardless of how you choose to measure it, is going to be exactly equally distributed among different identifiable populations or genetic populations of people. I agree with that, just on a purely logical point of view. Sure, yeah, there's going to be differences in gene frequency. I've said before that we shouldn't make our ethical and social and cultural determinations about racism dependent upon any scientific fact, because if that fact turns out not to be true, then you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. It's okay to say bigotry is wrong, racism is wrong, but, we may find that there's a different frequency of genes in different populations, and that's okay. But what we do know is that the difference in the big picture, and this is just a happenstance of evolutionary history, the difference is relatively small compared to all of human variation.
Steve, it's an interesting intellectual exercise to go over things like that, and I think mm-hmm. that's great. But I think we do need to be clear in the fact that James Watson is a racist kook because he says he doesn't say things that are backed up by science. He says things and backs them up with people who have to deal with black employees find this not to be true, meaning people aren't the idea that people are equal is found to not be true because people with black employees find that. That's so ridiculously racist, and he says things like this all the time.
I agree. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that he's not a racist. There are other things that he says, as you point out, that lead to that conclusion. What I'm saying, that doesn't mean, however, that everything he says is necessarily wrong.
I know. That's what I just said, is that, it's an interesting intellectual exercise to pick out what the little kernel of truth that he accidentally drops in here and there.
Yeah.
But let's keep a good perspective here and just come out and say that he is so very wrong and he has no evidence to back up his claims.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I would say that I disagree with his characterization of the research, as many people do, and he does betray, I think, a bias when in some of the things that he says. You know, I wouldn't trust his interpretation of the literature because he does betray that bias. But at the same time, we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater in that. That doesn't mean everything he says is wrong. And he does key in on certain things that other people have also pointed out that, you know, we should be able to just to study the genetics and let the chips fall where they may. And every time we find something, just looking at the evidence that says that, yes, there's differences in gene frequencies and genes that might correlate with some cognitive function, that doesn't mean necessarily you're a racist. I think that they're on the other side, those who are, for very noble reasons, are obviously they think that racism is wrong, of course, which we agree with. But I think there are those who politically are opposed to racism, and they try to silence any scientific discussion that may fuel bigotry or fuel racism.
Right, that's exactly what I'm saying.
I think that's a mistake to do that.
We're on the same page with that.
Great. Right. So the article also points out, just as an example, that a spokesman for the 1990 Trust, which is a black human rights group, said, "It is astonishing that a man of such distinction should make comments that seem to perpetuate racism in this way. It amounts to fueling bigotry, and we would like it to be looked at for grounds of legal complaint." So obviously I agree with the first part of that statement, but what he's saying is, and you know, apparently in Great Britain there are laws against racism, and what he's saying is that he thinks that they should look at like taking criminal charges against Watson for making these statements. You know, that reminds me of the discussion we had about like Holocaust denial. You know, just call him an idiot and a bigot, and
right. I mean, he's how old? He's going to die soon.
Yeah. I have a problem with like taking criminal activity.
Yeah, there's
criminal
no
action against somebody for saying comments like this, and that can be used to silence scientists who are not racists and who are just honestly doing genetics research, but whose findings that can be claimed can be used or twisted to fuel bigotry. But again, I file this under subjugating science to ideology. Even when the ideology is a good one, I think we still have to give the science free rein to find whatever it is. And you know what? We don't need to worry about what science discovers. It's not going to, you know, in any way, be a problem. As you know, we can have our ethics and our morals, and we can say that racism and sexism and all those things are bad without sweating what the science is going to discover. As long as the science is good, you know, as long as the science itself is legitimate.
And before we move on, I just want to say that to Jennifer, who wrote the letter. Someone who is trying to prove to you that white people are better is not somewhat racist. They're just racist.
That's a racist,
sound
yeah.
Way too smart and reasonable to be dating them. Just saying. Just
right.
saying.
And also what she's saying is that he's starting with a conclusion and looking to cherry pick evidence to fit his preconceived
right.
notion.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Working the wrong way. She's working the right way.
Cards before the horse.
Rather
she's
you should step back and say, well, what does the evidence show? Not let me look for evidence that supports my bias. Well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Mark Crislip. Mark, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you.
Mark does the very excellent podcast Quackcast, and he was on our show, I think it was just about a year ago, wasn't it, that you were first
this
on our show?
Right.
Yeah. We asked him to come back to talk to us primarily about the flu vaccine and all of the myths surrounding the flu vaccine, since we're just about to head into that season. So, Mark, just start by giving us a quick overview of what the flu vaccine is, why and why people should take it, and then we can start to talk about some of the common myths that you encounter about the flu vaccine.
Sure. Well, the flu comes around every year, and it's a pretty awful disease if you get the real flu. Influenza, that is. The flu is used as sloppily by a lot of people for things that aren't influenza. And it kills somewhere between 30 plus thousand people a year who get influenza. Sometimes more, sometimes less.
That's, so we do that in this country or worldwide?
That's the United States.
That's just the United States, 30,000 a year. And I forgot to mention for our audience that Dr. Mark Crislip is an infectious disease physician. That's his specialty.
So he knows what he's talking about, people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always tell people I'm chief of infectious diseases, and that sounds impressive until they realize I'm the only person who does it. Right. So it's easy to be emperor.
That's even more impressive.
You're chief of yourself.
At least you're not Jenny McCarthy on Oprah talking about
yeah.
it.
Right. So every year, flu comes around, and we try and get people vaccinated because it prevents people from getting the flu, and it prevents people from dying of flu, which is probably its better effect. Mm-hmm. And people don't get the vaccine for a wide variety of reasons, both in the hospital, where part of my job is to make sure people get vaccinated for flu, and in the real world, most of the times the healthcare system, such as it is not been very good at keeping people vaccinated. And it's a wide variety of reasons that that tends to happen.
What are some of the big ones?
Well, the big ones probably is that the one I hear most is I never get the flu, so I don't need the flu shot. And that's probably true. You haven't gotten the flu yet. And in any given year, probably 5 or 10% of people get the flu, but they're slumming. They're basically slumming on other people. They're relying on other people's immunity mm-hmm. and not getting it. And the big thing when you get it is you might give it to someone who's more likely to die. So if you're young and healthy, you haven't gotten the flu, it probably isn't going to be a big deal. But if you give it to your grandmother, it'll probably kill her. Now, you may stand to inherit from your grandmother, so that could be a good thing, but I don't think it's a good thing to kill people inadvertently, and so one of the big benefits, even if you don't get the flu, is you'll prevent it from other people from getting it. That's a big, important reason.
Do a lot of people get a subclinical infection? In other words, do they get exposed to it and pass it on without ever realizing that they had the flu because they didn't get any symptoms?
That's not as common with influenza as other viruses.
Okay.
Now, you can get a partial illness if you have partial immunity from older vaccines, but usually when you get flu, you get sick, and you try and cough up your spleen. So it's a bad illness.
It's funny, Mark, because you say, talking about the reasons why people don't get it, I never got one because, not because I never get the flu, but because I always heard the people who should get the vaccine are the elderly, the people with lung diseases, with heart diseases. And I never see it stressed anywhere that who should get it is everybody. Do you feel like that kind of education is lacking?
Well, the big push is to give it to people who are going to get killed from it. But, you know, it may be that the CDC guidelines suggest anybody who doesn't want to get the flu should get the vaccine. That mm-hmm. seems a pretty good reason for me so that you don't pass it to other people.
Mark, is it possible that we could get rid of the flu if everybody got vaccinated?
That's a good question. I don't know. I doubt it. Because there are reservoirs outside of humans, and unfortunately, unlike, say, polio, where the vaccine seems to be almost 100% effective, the flu vaccine is not 100% effective. So even if everybody got the flu vaccine, there'd be new strains next year and new types, and it's not a very good vaccine as vaccines go. So unfortunately, we could probably never get rid of the flu.
How effective is it percentage-wise? What percentage of the viruses that are out there in any given year will be blocked by the vaccine?
Depending on the year, somewhere between 60 and 80% of people who get the vaccine will be protected from getting influenza,
mm-hmm.
which isn't too bad.
That's actually a lot higher than I thought it was.
Yeah, me too.
Well, if you're young and healthy, it's high, and if you're old like me with lots of medical problems, then you're less likely to get a response to it. And then there's a subset of people who are just genetically predisposed to not respond to the vaccine. So that will also increase the risk of the flu spreading through the community and other people getting it.
Mark, what kills you? What kills you when you get the flu?
Both the flu itself, and then you get secondarily infected with bacterial. So you get a bacterial pneumonia on top of your viral pneumonia. And they think that's maybe what it killed a lot of people in the big pandemic in 1918, 1919. Though a lot of people died of influenza, a lot of people probably died of staph and strep pneumonias that secondarily infected people.
Now, what are some of the big myths about the vaccine that you think might be a barrier to people getting vaccinated?
Well, one is it doesn't work. Many people don't think it doesn't work. And it does. It's effective. People think that the vaccine is worse than getting the flu. And I don't know. I think a little sore arm is not as bad as dying. Mm-hmm. But I'm old-fashioned that way. And the one that's most aggravating is the people say, yeah, I get the vaccine, and it gives me the flu, which is not even remotely possible. It's a killed vaccine, and you can't get the flu from a killed vaccine.
Can you get flu-like symptoms but not the flu?
Well, what are flu-like symptoms? For me, flu is you got a fever to 104, you feel like you've been pummeled with a hammer, and you're trying to cough up your spleen. That's the symptoms of the flu. And all these sort of grunge like I have today, I don't have flu-like symptoms. I have cold-like symptoms. You get a little sick. You get a little myalgia, a little muscle aches, a little fever, don't feel too good for a day. But, you know, it beats dying.
Yeah.
For some people.
Absolutely.
Is it true that the effectiveness of the flu shot varies from season to season or year to year?
Yeah, because they have to pick a different a new strain every year. And unfortunately, unlike for chickenpox and other vaccines, they have to guess at the end of this flu season what's going to be their next flu season. Because it takes a long time to gear up for the vaccine. Every vaccine represents one chicken egg.
Yeah.
So if you're going to vaccinate 300 million people, one poor chicken is laying all those eggs. And it takes a long time for that one poor chicken to turn out 300 million eggs just for the United States alone.
Is it true that the vaccines you get from the dollar store come from China and have lead in them?
The dollar store.
I don't think you're allowed to do that.
Is it too early to get it? Should you wait until December or should you do it right away?
There's no reason to wait.
No reason to wait. And the immunity lasts through the flu season. Okay, so it's a good time to get it.
Now, getting back to the egg production question, I remember even just a few years ago, partly because of the threat of bioterrorism and increased awareness of this, there's a lot of discussion about the vulnerability of our vaccine infrastructure and the inability to rapidly ramp up a vaccine if a new strain of, especially in the context of bioterrorism, was released. And there was a lot of talk about the fact that the using eggs, chicken eggs to make vaccines is really old technology. And we need to develop new techniques that would enable us to produce vaccines much quicker. And maybe we could have a short enough turnaround time that we could actually produce a vaccine from this year's strain. Do you hear anything about that? Did that technology, is it still in the works, or was that just all pie in the sky?
Well, last I heard at the meetings last year, they think they're about 6 years away from genetically engineering influenza vaccine. I don't know why it's going to take so long, because you think it'd be easy just to pop those genes into an E. coli and churn it out, but they say it's 5 or 6 years, and then there's the whole approval process for these things takes forever.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that's slowing it down, but supposedly they're going to stop using chickens and use genetic technology to generate the vaccine at some point, and that would be a lot better for churning stuff out for a pandemic or something like that.
But that's, you say, at least 5, 6 years away.
Yeah, last I heard.
Another thing that comes up, and I hear this a lot because this is a topic that I'm interested in, is mercury in vaccines. Now, there's a whole anti-vaccination movement, and part of what they claim is that mercury in the preservative thimerosal in some vaccines causes neurological disorders like autism. Now, the flu vaccine is one of the vaccines that still contains thimerosal as a preservative. According to the CDC, there will be about 10 to 12 million doses of thimerosal-free vaccine available in the 2007-2008 flu season, and the only vaccines licensed for children, young children, are thimerosal-free. But still, much of the flu vaccine that will be given does contain thimerosal.
Yeah, I don't know. You know better than I that there's no risk in thimerosal for neurologic damage, and the vaccines are safe as anything you can get. They have side effects, no doubt about it, but so do airbags in cars. But I wouldn't take the airbags out of a car just because occasionally one person has an unfortunate complication during an accident.
Mm-hmm.
You said the FDA has taken thimerosal out of these vaccinations. So if there's no harm, why would the FDA do that?
Well, I always tell the residents that the United States has 80% of the world's lawyers. I don't know if that's true or not. I read that somewhere. And once you got, they have to do something with their time, so they do it out of paranoia.
So strictly political, or it has nothing to do with science.
It's to be safe, better safe than sorry, and there's not a good reason. But unfortunately, that's helped generate help the anti-vaccine liars, as another person calls them. And it hasn't been it's probably to their detriment that people aren't getting the vaccines.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, it was done, the justification was to be on the safe side and to just, wherever possible, eliminate human exposure to mercury. And it was partly done as a PR move, but I think it largely backfired because then it created that exact question, why take it out if it's harmless? you know, from a public relations point of view, it hasn't had the effect I think that they were hoping it's going to have. But, you know, the CDC and the FDA, they're in a no-win scenario with the anti-vaccination crowd. There's nothing you could do to placate them, so you might as well not even try.
Yeah, they live in a different planet. When you read their websites and their literature, you kind of want it. Sometimes I think there's a whole different world, alternative dimension that some people wander through. And they're certainly on the anti-vaccine websites. Though I did find one really good one where vaccines will get rid of your psychic abilities.
Is that right?
Will those sap you of your chi?
And that everybody who doesn't get the vaccine can see the spaceships and the aliens whizzing through the air. But if you get your vaccine, you lose that ability to see spaceships and space aliens, and your psychic ability goes away.
Hey, Mark, I have a question for you. I'm sure some of our listeners might want an update on the bird flu. Have you been keeping up with it?
Yeah, it's slowly marching across the world and is now in Eastern Europe and Africa. And there's just a report out this week to show it's undergone a new mutation that inches it a little closer to being more infective in humans. So, you know, whether this is going to be the one to sweep the world or not, I don't know, obviously. But it's always ominous when you read these reports how the receptors are getting that it binds to, or the proteins that it binds to human receptors are getting more available, that it's becoming able to grow at human rather than bird temperatures. And it seems to be slowly inching its way towards a human pandemic. But if, you know, we'll probably get blindsided by one we don't expect. But,
So sleep well tonight, folks.
Oh, yeah.
Well, all right, don't just leave us hanging like that. So what do you think? Like, is it something to worry about? Is there something we can do?
If history repeats itself, we're going to get another pandemic. And it may be this strain, it may be another. But they happen with great regularity going back forever. And there's no reason not to think we're not going to have it again. How's that for a bunch of negatives? I don't know what I just said.
That wasn't terrible. Don't worry about it.
These things always happen, and they happen again and again, and history always repeats itself.
So what could be done? If anything could be done, what would you recommend?
Billions and billions on nanobots.
I'll call Bob up, tell him.
Sorry, I'm a regular listener.
You'll be relieved to hear that.
No, probably just ramping up vaccines so you could get it without having to worry about the chicken eggs.
Yeah.
That would be the best way.
Yeah, that one chicken's going to have a hell of a time.
Oh, I know.
Does the chicken have a name?
I can't think of. Yeah, a little. Chicken Little.
Chicken Little.
Yeah. Oh, that guy from American Idol?
And good hygiene is important. I mean, washing your hands and covering your mouth when you cough, which most people don't do. There's always a big thing in the hospital. Someone's coughing. You know, cough into your hand, cough into your. But people just sort of cough, and it's a very efficient way of spreading infection. And people cough all the time, all over the place, and they don't cover up. Mm-hmm. If you just cover your mouth.
Simple manners, people.
Mark, a quick scenario. The bird flu hits. It's ramping up like crazy. What should the common person do?
What they're going to do is just not go out. And that will abort
the spread.
Spread. Yeah, because it's spread person to person, and people aren't congregating. And there have been some studies that looked at the 1919 pandemic. And basically, by shutting down schools, shutting down work, shutting down everything, and everybody stay at home, people didn't get influenza. And then, you know, I think President Clinton had it right when he said, you know, don't inhale. Take a deep breath and go for 3 months.
So would it be 3 months, you think?
Yeah, how long? Most flu last 3 to 4 months.
So we'd have to quarantine ourselves for 3 months?
Yeah. So, you know, stock up on your ramen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, there's been some depressing scenarios. I'm blanking on the guy's name. He used to run public health from Minnesota. He was on NPR giving a talk on if it hits like it did and basically no one goes to work for 3 months, what it will do to our just-in-time economy. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, hospitals are just in time, and we get all our stuff just as we run out. If half the nurses aren't showing up to work, if half the doctors aren't showing up to work, if the people that cart away the corpses aren't showing up to work, it could be a little unpleasant.
Yeah. Okay, good answer.
But on the bright side, maybe we'll get hit by an asteroid.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Yeah. It'll be the thing you don't worry about that's going to happen.
Something tells me the pandemic
maybe
will
the time
first.
Dimension will disappear and we won't have to worry about it.
Although Jay worries about everything, so it'd be hard to blindside him.
Do you really think I worry about everything?
It's kept him alive so far, so.
So far, so good.
Am I a crybaby? What are you talking about?
Mark, I was reading recently about concerns to move away from viruses towards bacteria, that there is actually a strain of staph, which is staph aureus, which is a type of bacteria that is killing more people than the HIV virus. You've read about this?
Yeah, I saw an article in JAMA today, and then a very badly written article out of the New York Post, where it's amazing how many things they get wrong in the newspaper.
Yeah.
In the one area I know something about, they always get things wrong. I just, drives me nuts. But yeah, staph has been getting increasingly resistant for about a decade now. And currently, it's become sometimes impossible to kill staph off in patients who have staph infections. And it's been a huge problem in hospitals and in the community with this current strain of staph aureus that's wandering through.
And you find out that the estimate that it's killing more people than HIV, which is like the big scary infectious disease these days, that's accurate?
You know, AIDS, no one dies like of AIDS. I haven't had a death due to AIDS this century. I mean, really, the new therapies have just been unbelievable. People just don't die of the disease. Like in the old days, they just died like flies, to use the old metaphor. But staph kills people all the time these days. I mean, not in huge numbers, but it was like how many they put? 28,000? I forget the number.
Was it 30,000?
30,000? So kind of like an influenza year.
Yeah, that's scary, you know.
And if you put 30,000, I just looked in the paper today just to get a rough idea. You know, 30,000 would be about 1 per 100 per million people, which over a year's time, you know, it'd be like 1 every 3 days, which wouldn't really show a big blip in your obituary columns.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that's a significant number of people who die of staph, and it's getting almost impossible to kill this bug anymore.
Yeah. And it's a real pain in the hospital because they got to gown up and glove up every time you walk into a patient's room. But is there any talk of a solution on the horizon? What do we do about this? Because it seems like it's just getting worse year by year.
I'm real pessimistic about this. I don't think there's going to be a solution. I mean, we've mostly run out of most of the sites for antibiotic use. Pharmaceutical companies aren't doing any research into antibiotics because they can't make any money off them. As we use the few agents we have left, we're already starting to see resistance to that. I mean, I pretty much figure that by the time I retire, another 15 years, staff's going to be resistant to all known antibiotics. And they've already had some strains doing that. It's only going to increase. And I think it's pretty bleak, actually. And I don't see any good news in the resistance to antibiotic. I mean, we're slowly sliding into the post-antibiotic era, and I don't think there's a hell of a lot you can do about it.
Mm-hmm. What the hell, guys?
Well,
what the hell?
Yeah, Mark and Steve.
Tell me this shit. Never gonna sleep again.
I mean, maybe they're going to come up with some new mechanism to kill the bugs off, but with one exception or two, most of the other sites and bacteria share too much homology to humans. So when you give them, we get the same effects in humans that you do in bacteria.
That's bad.
When you go to the meetings, it's a lot of me too drugs, but not a lot of new stuff seems to be coming through the pipeline to kill these organisms off.
So we're just losing the evolutionary war with these microbes.
Oh, yeah. You know, I once did a rough calculation that 30 years for bacteria is about 6 million years for human beings. Mm-hmm. So 6 million years ago, we were Lucy wandering around the plains of Ethiopia. Yeah.
These little pricks are going to be talking to us in another 10, 15 years.
they're going to be dancing in our graves and singing a good song. Oh, Dirge, God, I'll tell you. And I do actually, I shouldn't probably say this, but I have a confession to make on the basis of last week's podcast to you guys.
Mm-hmm.
I probably shouldn't say this, but I feel obligated. I've been using a fanny pack for 15 years.
Mark, you have to upgrade. You have to upgrade to the utility belt now.
Do you wear your cell phone?
My cell phone's in the pocket, but for the business cards and all the little odds and ends, and I carry a stool specimen with me.
Of course you do.
I'll send you a picture of my stool specimen if you'd like.
Thanks.
I carried it around in my fanny pack, and I've been using one for 15 years, so you can think what you will of me.
Oh, I will.
But if we do come up with like the cool ass Batman style belt, will you buy one?
It depends on the emblem on the front.
Well, it could be we could put like a
it's going to have the Skeptics Guide emblem on it. Come on.
Yeah. Okay.
It needs a picture of James Randi on it or something.
It'll be cool.
Rebecca couldn't be as dismissive.
Yeah, I mean, I would consider that. You know, I think Batman's cool. You know, don't get me wrong. But, it's just a fashion don't, like wearing the cell phone on the belt. That says, I wish I was Batman, but I'll never be Batman. I work in a cubicle.
If you go to the Oxford English Dictionary and you look up the word dork, you'll see my picture. So I long ago gave up worrying on that issue.
I want to hear from a reader or a listener who actually manages to pick up a chick while wearing a fanny pack.
I bet you if I had my stethoscope on at the same time.
Well, I commend your honesty, Mark. I really do, man.
All right, Mark, thanks again for joining us. It's a pleasure as always.
It sounded like a public service announcement today.
That's right.
Go get your vaccine! All right, well, thank you.
All right, take care, Mark.
It was good talking
to
you, Mark.
Good night,
right,
Mark.
Bye.
And now, Randy speaks.
Randy, can you give us an example of one of your more successful mentalism tricks?
When I was about 17 years of age and starting into my mentalism career in Toronto, Canada. Now, mind you, I was still going to school, so I did this only in my spare time. One episode when I was quite thrilled to be able to perform at the Royal Alexandra Theatre. Now, that was and still is, a very classy location on King Street West in Toronto, Canada. The only time that I ever stepped into the Royal Alexandra Theatre and actually got to walk on the stage. I was hired as a mentalist, and tickets had been sold for this event for quite some time in advance. What I'll do is I'll tell you the effect of what I did when I walked out on stage, and then we'll go back in time a little bit and see how I was able to do this. I walked out on stage, introduced myself as a mentalist, and said that I was able to pick up thoughts from people in the audience, and that I was a total stranger to everyone in the audience, et cetera, et cetera, the usual thing. I did a couple of opening bits that got a moderate amount of applause. I dropped a bong in their midst. I waved my hand over the audience and pointed at a lady sitting at the end of the third row right on the aisle. And I said, "Excuse me, ma'am." I said, "I get a strange impression from you." And she held her hand to her chest to say, "Moi." And I said, "Yes, you. Would you stand?" And she stood up. And I said, "Have I ever met you before?" The usual thing. And she said, "No." I said, "Well, I get a strange impression. I get a strange impression. I cast my mind back to your home, and I get a very nice place with a few hills around it." And I named the district in Toronto, and she was appropriately impressed because that's where she did live. It was a nice, expensive residential area. And I said, I have a peculiar impression, and I'm going to ask you to explain this to us if it's correct. I'm getting crossed hands like an X. I said that they're like arrows, and they're crossed one over the other. And she looked puzzled, and I said, it seems to be something that you own, and I believe you've owned it for many years. It's a, oh goodness, it's made of porcelain. At least part of it is made of porcelain and glass. And, oh, it's a clock. It's a clock. And her hand flew to her mouth. And she was obviously quite astonished, and I knew I'd made a big hit. And she started to explain and said, no, let me tell you. The crossed hands on the clock, now, the hands on the clock don't cross, but on this particular one, they seem to do. And she tried to blurt something out, and I said, no, let me tell you, please. And I'm getting roses. I don't know whether the roses are sitting beside the clock. And now she was distraught. She was just having a fit, and she was having an attack of the vapors, as we used to say. And she recognized what I was apparently seeing in my mind. And I said, "There's something wrong with that clock. In fact, the clock is not working. Am I correct?" She said, "Yes, yes." And I said, the hands have fallen off the clock, and they are crossed. And I made a sign with my crossed fingers in front of my body. And she sat down very suddenly, and she started to fan herself. And I said, "Are you okay?" And she said, "Oh, yes, but how did you know this?" She said, "You see the clock." And I said, wait, let me finish. I said, and the roses would the roses be part of the clock or marked on the clock in some way? She says, oh, yes, on the porcelain dial, little pink roses. That's part of the design on the dial. And the audience was now stilled. And I went on and I said, and you haven't gotten around to fix it yet because you're waiting for someone to fix it, but you can't tell a clock with no hands if they're laying at the bottom of the dial behind the glass. And now she was having a total fit. And I said, well, I'll leave it at that because I see you're rather distressed by this. And she said, oh, yes, oh, my. Well, I got huge problems on that. That took, it tore the house down. Anything I did from then on was an anticlimax. My good friend Terrence K. Lawson was backstage, and he was cheering me on. Now, let me tell you, first of all, how that was done. Terrence Lawson had a Studebaker. Now, a Studebaker in those days was a car you couldn't tell whether it was coming or going the way it was built, and that was what everybody laughed at. But and he was the only one in all of the people, the young people that I knew of our age, who actually had a car. That was a family car, and he tooled around in that car. So he was mobile, and I certainly wasn't, except for my bicycle. I set him in the lobby of the Royal Alexandra Theater when they put the tickets on sale for this big extravaganza they were having that was featuring Bois. And I thought maybe I could get some information this way. And sure enough, Lawson was standing by with the sunglasses on, looking nonchalant, this kind of thing, when a little old lady stepped up to the bottom. She said she wanted tickets, and she named the show. And she said she'd like something on the aisle so that she could have easy access to the aisle. And the gentleman named the numbers of the tickets and gave them to her. And it was just wonderful. She then gave the, she had to charge them in some way, and I've forgotten how it was done in those days, but she had to give her name and her address, and of course Lawson stood there and secretly made note of that. And he, when she went outside and she got into a taxi, he jumped to the Studebaker and followed the taxi all the way up, and I've forgotten the name of the district in Toronto, but the district that she lived in. Not long after that, he came by with a briefcase and knocked on the door. He called her by name. And she answered her, and she said, yes. He said, I'm from the University of Toronto, which is true. And I'm doing a survey. And he said, I'm not trying to sell you anything. I just need to ask you 10 simple questions about your insurance needs. And she said, oh, yes, come in. And she invited him in, luckily, and wanted to offer him tea and cookies and the whole thing. And he accepted graciously. And he noticed a clock sitting on the mantelpiece. And it had roses on the dial. And the hands had fallen off the face of the clock and were crossed at the bottom of the dial. Well, that's how the information was obtained, you see. And he did the survey. He didn't call any attention to the fact that he'd noticed the clock. And he left and went on his way. And he transferred this information to me. Now, I knew where those seats were in the theater, of course. From the back of the stage, he signaled to me, yes, that's the woman in the chair that had bought the tickets. I was able to pull off this wonder of mentalism by that means. But I must add that seeing how disturbed she was at this great revelation that I could not possibly have obtained by any other means but psychic means, I insisted to Lawson that we had to watch for her at the door and grab her. And indeed, he went outside. He waited till she exited, and he asked her if she'd come around to the dressing room door at the back. And she did that. And she said, oh, you called upon me. Personally, I said, yes, because I want you to understand what happened. I said, we did a bit of spying. It was all a trick. And I explained to her how it was done. And she laughed, and she was so amused by that. She said, oh, that's wonderful. How clever. And she hugged Terry, and she hugged me, and she went on her way. Because I felt that it had been so important to her that she would be carrying the story of this wonderful mentalist who out there was able to spiritually or psychically or somehow develop this information about her. I wanted her to know how it was done because I felt guilty letting her walk away with this delusion.
And imagine if you had less scrupulous motives, what you could achieve with such simple tricks.
Oh, the next move would have been, of course, to get her on my mailing list and to solicit. Now, she was living in a very, very expensive area of Toronto. That home had to be worth a lot of money, and she looked as if she was a single elderly lady, probably a widow. We could have milked her for all kinds of money, and I'm sure she would have given it up gladly. But that wasn't the nature of the beasts that we were.
Randy, thank you.
Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts. Two are real, and one is fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. The theme is honey.
Honey.
Honey. Okay. Are you guys ready?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Okay. Item number one. A new review of research concludes that honey is an effective treatment for wound healing. Item number two, researchers have developed a method for converting buckwheat honey into biofuel, which they claim is more efficient than corn or even sugarcane-based biofuel. Item number three, honey never spoils, and in fact, honey was found sealed in jars in Egyptian tombs and was still edible. Rebecca, go first.
Oh, man. I don't know anything about honey. I know jack all about honey, but so honey can heal wounds. That kind of makes sense. Honey as a biofuel, that seems really obvious. Like, they can make anything out of biofuel, right? It seems like every week there's something new that somebody can jam into a car that they claim is more efficient. And honey never spoiling. Oh, man. And still edible? Like, who tried that out? Who ate that? Like, what poor lab monkey was forced to eat the 2,000-year-old honey? Okay, I'm going to say that it's not true that honey can be turned into biofuel, because that seems the most obvious choice to be true. So I think that you're trying to fool us.
All right, Evan?
I agree with Rebecca. I think the thing here is that, yeah, they can develop the method for converting it, but more efficient than corn or sugarcane? I don't buy that part of it. So I say that's fiction.
Alrighty, Jay?
Okay. I know one of these is true.
Uh-huh.
Two of them
absolutely
are true.
I know two of them are true.
100% certain. No, in my knowledge.
I know two are true and one is fake.
Yeah, but do you know which one exactly is fake?
Look, let's not pick nits.
I'm down to a 50-50 shot here.
Well, flip your coin and go.
I would say that converting honey, buckwheat honey. What's buckwheat honey, by the way, Steve?
Well, there are different kinds of honey depending on what flower's pollen is being used.
Looking pin up in all the wrong
places. So assuming that bees actually converted the nectar or pollen into honey is probably a mistake for me at this point, because it doesn't actually say that, but I'm, you know, because they can make honey artificially without having bees, just, you know, we're not, whatever. You
artificial
get
honey?
No, they don't need bees to do it. They can make honey.
What are you talking about?
In other words, they can take the pollen and put it through a similar process, right, and make honey without it actually having going through the machine of a bee. Would you?
Because they can.
I'm derailing you. I'm sorry. Go on.
That ain't natural. Okay.
I
would have gone on with you for half an hour about that.
What's your point, Jay?
My point is, like, I'm going through the process here. I'm thinking, well, it's not efficient to collect honey from bees and turn it into fuel. That would be, you know, ridiculously difficult. But if they can produce the honey on their own and then use that as a base to create fuel, that makes a little bit more sense to me. Honey is an effective treatment for wound healing. Okay. I think that one is possible, too. So I'm going to say number two just doesn't sound. Something's not right about it.
All right. So you guys are unanimous about the honey biofuel.
Yeah.
You all agree that honey is... You should rub honey in your wounds. That honey is good for...
I do it every day.
And not necessarily topical, but...
And that one is science. And yes, it is topical, Ev. Oh. It is meant to be rubbed into your wounds. So this was a review of existing research, and I looked up a lot of these studies, and the research is pretty consistently in the direction that putting honey into wounds does stave off infections and help the wounds heal faster, probably just because it's staving off infections. The reason for that is because honey has several properties which make it good as a way of sealing a wound from infection. It has a very low moisture content, and it's acidic, and it has a high sugar content, and it creates a very unfriendly environment for bacteria. One recent study, which is a large double-blind study, compared it to an artificial gel that's used for wounds, and they found that it worked as well. So there's nothing superior about it than stuff that's already existing, but it worked as well as the surgical wound healing gel, but it's a lot cheaper, actually.
Steve, would honey work on woo wounds?
What?
I was going to say that, but I didn't want to embarrass myself.
thanks, Evan.
Let's skip to number 3. Honey never spoils, and in fact, honey was found sealed in jars in Egyptian tombs and was still edible.
Dun, dun, dun.
You guys think that one's true, huh?
We know, well, we know
I,
it's
I
true.
Hope so.
That one is science.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Sweet.
Sweet like honey.
Sticky.
So I've read this in dozens of websites. I couldn't find a single source that refuted this claim, but it took me a while to find a source that I found credible enough to say, okay, I'm going to go with this as something that's probably true. There are reports of archaeologists finding honey in Egyptian tombs and then cracking
and
it open and
it?
Taking a fingerful and eating it. And it's
what
still
is wrong with them?
I guess they wanted to see if you could still eat it.
Maybe it was mummy brains. How did they know it was honey?
Well, there's also a story, and this one site I found traced it back to a book that was published in the 1890s. And this story then got retold in a number of different sources of... It's the story of the archaeologists who find the sealed jar and that filled with honey, and they start eating the honey, and then they realize only too late that there's actually a body preserved in the jar as well.
Ooh,
so they
say,
hey, what's this,
see?
A hair,
why
a
don't
finger?
They listen to me?
But that piece of the story may not be true. That's kind of like the sailor in the rum barrel story. You guys heard that one? Sort of
sure.
The accidental cannibalism is kind of an urban legend of its time. But, you know, but I found some credible sources. Again, nothing really firsthand, so I have to leave open the possibility that that particular story about the archaeologist may be apocryphal. But honey does, it is the one food that really doesn't spoil, as long as it's sealed. Because in the process that the bees go through in making the honey from the pollen, they do take out, they cure it, they do get the water content down very, very low, and they get the pH down very low, so it's very acidic. And that is an environment that is not friendly for the growth of either yeast or bacteria or anything that would spoil it. So if it's sealed, it will not spoil and it will stay good indefinitely, apparently. However, if it's unsealed, honey also has the property that it will absorb water from the atmosphere. Now, this is a good thing if you're using it in foods that you want, and it could help that food maintain its moisture because it will absorb moisture from the atmosphere. But if it's the honey itself is just left open, its water content will go up, and eventually yeast and stuff will start growing in the honey. And then the honey may actually even ferment. And I'm sure you guys know what fermented honey is.
Mead,
right.
Mead.
So you can actually make an alcoholic drink.
Of course, nerds would know that.
Yeah, out of fermented honey. The notion that honey does not spoil as long as it's kept sealed is science. This all means that, number 2, researchers have developed a method for converting buckwheat honey into biofuel, which they claim is more efficient than corn or even sugarcane based biofuel, is fiction. I made that one up. I could not find anything about honey biofuel. There is no particular reason why you couldn't make biofuel out of honey. It has sugar in it. You know, you could make biofuel out of it. I don't necessarily think it would be a particularly efficient source of biofuel, and no one appears to be doing it as far as I could find. Well, normally, this is the point in the show where we come to the skeptical puzzle of the week. Before that, we're going to read the results of our skeptical limerick contest. We have gotten dozens of submissions. So thank everyone. Thank you all of our listeners who took the time to write and send in your limericks. We read every single one of them, and we appreciate you sending them all in. A lot of them were terrible.
Awful.
I mean that. I mean that in the best possible way. But no, seriously, it was all across the board. There was some rhyming and some meter issues with a lot of them, but
some were sonnets.
Many of them were fine. The second round, when we gave the extension, the second round was definitely better. So people definitely took it up.
It takes
a
little practice. It's not.
Yeah, there were more submissions were on the limerick meter, so they were good. What we did was we each picked our two favorite limericks from the ones that were sent in, and we also have one that we each wrote ourselves. And so we're each going to read you our favorite limericks, including one of our own devising. Evan, would you like to go first and read your picks?
Yeah, I'll read the two picks. Too bad I had to narrow it down to two. I felt there were more than that. But these are the two that touched me. Of ghosts I'd always been wary, and psychics' claims always deemed hairy. But until I knew the SGU crew, I still had my skeptical cherry. That's from Bonnie in Minneapolis. And then there's this one. Alt-Med is as dense as a thicket. Some docs confuse curate with pricket. When some flake starts to wheedle and pulls out his needle, just tell the old quack where to stick it. Dave,
that's a good one.
Dave and Ann Anderson from St. Louis.
Jay, you ready?
I'm going to read this one that I liked, and I wish that we had more time so we could read a bunch of them, but I don't want to upset anyone. So don't take it personally that I'm not reading yours. But this one is from Ben Williams in Australia, and I thought this one was kind of funny. As skeptics, we often say no to the crazy or misled or slow, but we're mostly polite as we strive to make right and avoid telling nut jobs to blow.
Got to give them props for
yeah, well, that's the other qualification that I promised myself. It had to be right meter-wise.
It had to scan, yeah.
I have
got another one?
A couple I wrote. One of them is, of course, about Tom Cruise. Going to destroy the world. This isn't my favorite one that I wrote, but here it is. There once was a boy named Tom Cruise who said stupid things on the news. From inside his crib, he cries, "Don't be glib," as he puts 5-inch lifts in his shoes.
Fair
and
nice.
Then I wrote one about
way to pick on
well done,
one
well
about
done,
Neil
yeah.
Adams, and I came up with 5 different endings for it. Neil Adams would like you to know that Earth has a penchant to grow. While grasping for straws, he will point out your flaws. He puts the KO in wacko. Or, he'd have better odds with Lotto. Or, but what if the earth is hollow? Or, he should have just drawn his hero. My least favorite, his science is less than pseudo. Anyway.
First one was best.
All right, well, I got a couple of picks. I also picked one from Ben Williams. He sent it in quite a few, and they all rhymed quite well. I like this one. At the health shop, a young man had queued to have treatments and potions issued. He began to suspect that they had no effect, and he thought they should call this stuff food. That was a pretty good one.
Clever.
I had to choose an all-med one. And then Zachary Nash sent in this one. We had a lot of monkey bird limericks, and this was one of my favorite. Zachary wrote, "Of the battle between monkey and bird, clearly, monkey is always preferred. Its powerful grip can give a beak flip, then bombard the poor bird with its turds."
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
A little bonus rhyme in there. That's good.
Yes.
Very nice.
And internal rhymes, you always got to get cred for that. And then there's the one I wrote. "There once was a psychic from Salem who liked to kill cats that impale him. Whenever she'd come, the cats would all run and hope that their feet wouldn't fail them."
Cute.
Oh, God.
Tip of the hat to Halloween coming up.
Right, a little Salem in there. You got the really classic limerick form usually has as a location in the first line.
Yeah.
Oh, yep. That's not necessary, though.
No, I said the really classic. It's optional.
You can't
optional.
Really classic. What does that mean?
I'm just something. Telling you what I read. I don't know.
Hitchens-esque.
All right, Rebecca, hit it.
Okay, let's see. There were a lot of good ones near the end there, so I did have a little bit of trouble narrowing it down. But some of my favorites on the message board, Giles, or maybe it's Giles, it's with a G. He's got a funny little monkey avatar. And so, of course, his limerick actually is about monkeys. It goes, "A skeptic of unique perspective once stunned the assembled collective. If one were to give a monkey a shiv, then an ostrich would prove ineffective."
Nice.
I thought that one was really cute. And then one poster to the message board named Dr. Atlantis, he actually did 20 limericks all about fallacies. So 20 different limericks about 20 different logical fallacies. And
wow.
They were all pretty damn good. So I just picked one that I really liked, and that was the post hoc ergo prompter hoc limerick, which goes a little something like this. "The best time I scored with a chick was after I'd gotten quite sick. So now I gag before each date, and the results have been great. And when I'm nauseous, I start getting thick."
Oh, well done.
A little dirty. So, of course, I liked it. I wrote one.
Oh, let's hear
it. It is. "So I co-host the Skeptical Cast with my friends, though we have quite a blast. I'll soon be abstaining because Libra is waning, and my psychic, she says it won't last."
Wow. Yeah.
So, yeah, I have to say I'm done. Sorry, guys.
You admit to having a psychic.
So we are compiling all of these limericks, every one, and we will publish them in some form on our website. Evan, this brings us to the puzzle.
Yep.
Can you read last week's puzzle, please?
Yep, last week's puzzle. "Deserted some time ago from a plain red place, as Pluto crossed the sky, four horses led the way. Gazing down on all the animals, it seemed improbable that animals made them. Despite the insistence of the AA crowd, foreign visitors were not responsible. What is it?" And the answer,
answer
is the Nazca drawings. The Nazca.
Yes. Nazca did a lot lines. of correct answers on that one, but who got it first?
Ole Ivand, and he's gotten a few of these puzzles correctly first, so congratulations, Ole. And again, just to review, deserted some time ago, the word desert was in there as a little hint, from a plain red place. So plain red, I took that from the area the Nazca art is that it was created in is called the Pampa Colorada, or Red Plain. Four horses led the way, gazing. As Pluto crossed the sky, four horses led the way. This probably created the most confusion of people. So I was referring to the book Chariots of the Gods by Eric von Däniken, who is, of course, a believer that the Nazca lines were drawn by alien visitors from outer space as an alien landing strip or some such thing. So Pluto crossing the sky with his four horses is representational of a god in his chariot.
Okay, well done. And what's this week's puzzle?
Here's this week's puzzle. If I take 11 people, four bodies, a fiend, and a disc, along with four qualities, and I put them in between a vehicle and a building, what do I have?
A good party.
Got something. Remember, it is in the skeptical context, of course, yes. So think about it that way, and submit your guesses, and good luck, everyone.
All right. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
Jay, do you have a quote for us?
I have a quote. It's from Douglas Adams, and obviously Douglas Adams is an English author, and he wrote some of the best books known to mankind. And he says, this is actually a quote from The Hitchhiker's Guide, "There is a theory which states that if ever anybody discovers exactly what the universe is for and why it is here, it will instantly disappear and be replaced by something even more bizarre and inexplicable. There is another theory which states that this has already happened." Douglas Adams.
Good old Douglas Adams.
Yay, Douglas Adams.
He's one of those authors where every single sentence that he writes is funny.
But the best is his books on tape read by him.
Yeah.
I mean, they're priceless. They're priceless. Well, that is our show for this week. Thanks, everyone, for joining me again.
Thank you, Steve.
We survived despite all the sevens creeping up. It was a very good show.
We did. We survived.
I was a little worried.
Phew.
The multiple seven omens we survived.
Thank goodness. Yeah.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.
Problems, proof, endless delays.